Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. This podcast is being sponsored by Dynamis, a leading provider of information management software and security solutions. You can find them at dynamis.com. Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. I'm Eric Holdeman, your host, and with me today is Josh Dozer, who is General Manager, Medical and Security Assistance Services, servicing the Americas at International SOS. And we're going to learn more about International SOS and his duties there, but we're going to have a pretty wide-ranging interview with Josh, talking about his career, including his time at the White House, working with an internationally facing organization, then also his perspective on disaster trends that we are seeing. So please join me in welcoming Josh Dozer to the Disaster Zone podcast.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me. Good talking to you.
And you're coming to us from Philadelphia, is that right?
Yes, sir. We have our operations center servicing all of North America, the Pacific and the Caribbean, is based in Philadelphia.
And folks, Josh, before we started, took his camera, pointed it towards their, I'll call it operations center. It looks like any other coordination center or emergency operations center, tables, desks, wall displays, all ready to go.
Yeah, we have an operations center is about 130 persons strong. It's a mix of doctors, nurses, operations and logistics professionals, aviation experts, quality managers, learning development training folks, and security professionals and managers to support whatever our members need.
Okay. Well, we're going to learn more about that. And Josh, the first question I ask everybody is about their career. So what was your education and career path up until now, and how did you end up being an emergency manager? That's not someone's goal normally way back when.
Yeah, it's an interesting story because no one even usually growing up knows what an emergency manager is. I was a science major. I went to school for sciences and got involved with environmental science, learned regulation, felt like, you know, I liked that part. So I went to law school, didn't want to be a lawyer. And then I went to the Hill, and I said, you know, I want to go to the Hill and change the world. Young, idealistic. 9/11 happened, and that changed the world. I worked for an honorable Congressman Kurt Weldon from the 7th District of Pennsylvania, and he was in charge of the Fire Services Caucus, and he was a firefighter chief, and he led all the firefighter legislation. And so, by extension, I was the legislative aide who supported Congressman Weldon in first responder legislation after 9/11. Everything from public safety officer benefits, interoperability, communications planning exercises, ICS, the adoption of NIMS.
We're acronym free, and we do have some international audience. So when you say NIMS, you got to spell it out the first time.
Sir. So Incident Command System, National Incident Management System. These were principles that were indoctrinated within the fire service, but not really institutionalized as a homeland security profession. And so that's how I got into homeland security. And then eventually worked for the first committee on homeland security after 9/11, and worked on a variety of legislative bills and actions, and then moved to the National Security Council, where I was the director of preparedness policy. So after that, I just loved the operation so much. I said I wanted to transfer to FEMA and actually execute what we've been drafting and designing for so long.
Okay. And then how'd you end up where you are now then?
So I worked for FEMA for 13 years. I was in the government for 20. And, you know, I was looking for moving back up Northeast, where I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and my wife being from Long Island. And International SOS was the only company that I was aware of that had the same mission, the same public service doctrine and ethos to help people in times of need, support people, whatever it may be needed, during disasters, man-made incidents, crisis, you name it, anything that could happen would be on the front line. So that same mission really spoke to me, and it really drives me every day.
Okay, I'm particularly interested in two roles you had, that first one in Congress and then at the White House. If you can, give our listening audience a bit more detail on how these positions interact with the other levels of government, in the one case, the congressional staff duties, and then how White House policy folks then interface with both, I don't know whether the Department of Homeland Security was there then or the White House office first, and FEMA. How's that all interact together? What's the White House doing that FEMA's not doing, or vice versa?
Yeah, there's a lot there. So on the Hill, when I was on the Hill, remember it was after 9/11. So the country was in tremendous unity. They were aligned in one purpose and one mission. And on the House, you know, when I worked in the House of Representatives, there was no division between the Republicans and Democrats on Homeland Security. The division was between the House and the Senate. It was the House speaking from a very local risk perspective, while the Senate is looking at and approaching Homeland Security from a statewide perspective. And the differences were in the strategy of how we manage risks and mitigate risks from those two perspectives. It was a very interesting time, and we were able to get a lot done from that perspective. It was actually great fun in order to make a big difference from that perspective. On the Hill, though, there's a need to better understand and target the more administrative nuts and bolts of emergency management. Some of these topics are not very sexy or sometimes press-worthy, but you know, emergency management is, what is emergency management? It's contracting, it's emergency procurements, it's IT, it's personnel management and hiring, and being able to surge capabilities and deliver training. These are some fundamental nuts and bolts of emergency management that need to be addressed. And it's difficult to get in those areas. Usually in the Hill, it's topical. You know, it's the crisis of the day, and there's legislation that's built on the crisis of the day. When some of these more fundamental cruxes of emergency management, how
yeah, I'd call it building blocks, maybe, you know.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And so the Hill is working on those issues as they come, as the day. Now in the White House, it's very different. In the White House, the National Security Council, whenever there's a crisis, they're involved, and they have to pull any lever they can to address the problem. And I've served under Bush, I've served with Obama, served with under President Trump, and they're all the same. They all want to address the crisis. It's not political. It doesn't matter on your style. They all want to address the crisis as quickly as possible. And so every White House will quickly and immediately leverage FEMA to help them manage that crisis. Why? Because the crisis is a crisis of across jurisdiction. It's a crisis across disciplines and infrastructure sectors. And you need someone to be able to corral the different stakeholders, the different jurisdictions, the different organizations, all with different legislation or statutory authorities, and pull them together to a common purpose. And that's what emergency management is. That's the fundamentals. You follow a battle rhythm, you follow the planning process, and you look at the situation, you look at the courses of action, and you pick one and you move on. And that capability is fundamentally critical to any White House to address any crisis. And my experience is all the White Houses have pulled in FEMA for as many instances as possible.
Okay. All right. You know, when you talked about your time there, did you know Michael Byrne? He was in the office of
absolutely
Department of Homeland. Anyway, he hired me when I was back at King County to work for then ICF, international consulting firm. He went there after his term. And this is a story he told me, that he went in with then Secretary Ridge to see President Bush to make the plea for that first big grant of state and local funding for Homeland Security. And They pitched $3.2 billion is what was needed. And President Bush turned to him and said, "Is that enough?" And Mike said, "Sir, they've never seen this kind of money before." So it certainly was enough, when you get that type of shot of money when you haven't had it. But he's a good guy. He's actually with Deloitte today.
I know I've served with Mike many, many times,
okay,
continuously throughout FEMA. He's a great man.
He's been on this podcast. He's been in a lot of the major events. He was at 9/11, and he with ICF, he was down there doing the housing program. And then last big event, he did a big tornado outbreak too, but then he's Puerto Rico.
He worked, I think he worked Birmingham and Alabama tornado spreads. He was in Puerto Rico. I was there with him briefly there. I managed the National Response Coordination Center while he was the federal coordinating officer down
right there. He's a real operator. But we're not talking about Mike now anyway. But I think the majority of state and local emergency managers are very focused on their communities and execution of their programs here in the United States. I'd like you to broaden our horizons a bit with what is going on internationally from an emergency management perspective, because you might, have eyes on the Americas anyway, as part of your thing. What's going on out there that maybe we should just be aware of, understand that?
So company employees, students, non-government organizations providing humanitarian assistance, government officials are traveling all over the globe all the time. And they're traveling to sometimes very high risk locations. And when I mean high risk, it doesn't just mean security risk. It could be a medical risk. It could be a lack of medical infrastructure there, a pharmaceutical supply. And the risk managers of these organizations are under constant pressure to be able to provide guidance on whether to travel or not, which neighborhoods to go to, whether someone's fit to travel to that location based upon their personal circumstances and where they're going. And they need intel, they need analysis, they need decision-making tools. And then when something happens, and something, things are always happening, they need someone to go to help them manage that risk. So that level of global risk management is really a growing profession across corporate America and corporate global everywhere. And it's really a heavy burden. International SOS specializes in helping them enable them to manage that risk successfully. You know, recent crises include the Israel, Lebanon, West Bank missions. We're still evacuating people from Lebanon, West Bank, moving people across very complex jurisdictions, border controls, sometimes children who need significant medical attention to come back to where their home is or another close center of a medical care.
Yeah, and you're talking about international SOS now.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
Hurricane Otis, Acapulco. Again, Acapulco is a tourist destination. It's also a destination for a lot of corporate offsites and events. And so you have these offsites and events in these nice locations. They're at risk of natural hazards, and they have to manage that. So the Ukraine conflict is still producing assistance requirements. Niger, Ecuador, gang violence recently last month, and conflicts, the Haiti riots, and even the bubbling threats of China in the Taiwan Strait and the Philippines. These are bubbling threats and bubbling instances that we need to keep an eye on.
Okay. And so how many international SOS employees are there? I mean, are they deployed in every country or 100 countries? Or
so we have 26 large operation centers. We call them assistance centers. And they are key nodes across the globe. And their job is to receive calls and emails from folks in harm's way, and action and task themselves to provide deliver that assistance and maintain that network and deliver that assistance. But we also have hundreds of medical sites across the globe who are providing hands-on medical care and services to employees, corporations, non-government organizations, refugee camps, mining facilities, fisheries, canneries in austere locations all the time. And then we'll have personnel deployed to corporate sites or events, delivering assistance all the time as well. Many examples are include, I said, mining facilities, top offside, offshore topside platforms, oil platforms. You know, there's medical personnel who are providing care and making sure the folks are always fit to work and caring for them as they get injured. Those are international SOS employees delivering that assistance.
Okay, well, that's a pretty wide-ranging mission role, just not only geography-wise, but role-wise. And you run one of those 26 centers in Philadelphia, right? For I believe you call it the Americas. When you say the Americas, is that North and South America or what?
So we have a center in both Philadelphia and Mexico City. Mexico City is on point for most of LATAM, and we share some jurisdiction with Mexico City. So when I say the Americas, I'm thinking North, South America, and even Antarctica. We deliver assistance.
Okay. All right. And, you know, I can imagine major corporations, some of these businesses you talked about coming to you for assistance and contracting with international SOS. Is there, do governments come to you, like, you know, Absolutely. Lebanon or Israel, or when you talk about evacuating citizens and medical
Absolutely.
Care?
We provide direct support to a number of U.S. government agencies, as well as other foreign government entities. These could be long-term, long-standing contracts and support, like medical facility sites, or they could be spur-of-the-moment, as-needed missions. Air ambulance evacuations are a common example of some movement missions that we perform on behalf of government.
And you guys own and operate the aircraft, or you lease them?
It's a combination. We own a few aircraft that we own, operate, and man staff for deployment in Europe and Asia. But we also maintain a very robust provider network of third-party providers who we partner with to have equipment ready to go at all times. And it gives us options. It gives us the ability to pick and choose what's best for this patient, but based on time, location, and capability. And so each center, I mentioned 26 operation centers, each center is responsible for maintaining their network in that patch.
Okay.
We have over 100,000 partners across medical, security, aviation, and logistics, providers who we verify, credential, and have arrangements with to employ at a moment's notice.
Okay. So for states and local emergency management jurisdictions, which you're very familiar with based on your previous work history, would they ever have reason to contract with SOS International, or it's the federal agencies providing that support?
Yeah, there's basically two. We do have contracts with some states, actually. We have a very robust medical services capability. And in some instances, we are called upon to deploy a medical services site, professionals to provide emergency medical care downrange, as well as mental health support as required. In fact, during, we'll actually deploy to the joint field office and have the personnel at the joint field office, and they'll take direction under the state contract after the storm has passed to go downrange and set up their clinic and provide those emergency medical services under ESF-8, Emergency Support Function 8, to provide medical health at the direction of their chief medical officer.
And would that come through Health and Human Services?
So it'll come through the state's version of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay. All right. Their State Department of Health. Okay.
And
all right.
If there was ever a need to deploy overseas or to austere locations like the Pacific or the U.S. Virgin Islands or remote areas in the Northwest or Alaska, we have capabilities to be able to deliver and provide support for that as well. And so we'll often be called upon to provide some air medical evacuations and coordination if needed.
Yeah, I'm thinking of all these terms we use all the time, and I don't know whether I can remember. I'm thinking NDMS. What's NDMS?
National Domestic Medical System.
Yeah, so I could see you guys being involved with that, the evacuation of non-combatants or whatever.
Right. We were available for that, even search and rescue. You know, oftentimes we had some instances where Urban Search and Rescue Task Force 1 or 2 deployed to some austere foreign governments to lend assistance. We could be available to help them in the case that anyone of their members got injured or they were a successful rescue and needed to bring someone back to the United States.
Okay. I guess, you know, I've been in the biz now here 34 plus years before that in the military, way back when. But I've heard of, you know, SOS, the International SOS, but I'm really surprised about the extent of your capabilities and me not having a good understanding of it. I would think a lot of people don't know about your capabilities. I don't know. Do you guys ever present at something like the International Association of Emergency Managers Conference, or, you know, they always have the annual Hurricane Conference, or?
We should do IAM, International Association of Emergency Managers, and National Emergency Managers Association. We actually have not. We should do that because it's definitely an interesting take on the capability. It's a good idea. We're very engaged in the international and the domestic security communities.
Okay.
And the security associations. It's really, as well as some of the medical organizations as well.
Okay. Well, this has been fascinating for me there, Josh, but we're about halfway through, so I want to take a quick break for this message, and then we're going to be right back. So stand by.
This podcast is being sponsored by COBRA, an emergency management software solution. COBRA provides a cloud-based EOC software that is intuitive, collaborative, and affordable. Visit cobrasoftware.com.
And we are back, and we're talking today with Josh Dozer. He's with International SOS. And on the first half of this podcast, we learned a lot about their roles and missions. And I also appreciated his personal experience explaining that whole White House interface, National Security Council with FEMA and the congressional PCs had. So, but I'd like to switch gears here and talk more about what you've learned, Josh, in your wide-ranging career at you know, very senior policy level, I think. What do you think is the best way to impact policy at the federal level, since you've kind of had a bird's eye view up there looking at it?
Yeah, great question. So first, I have three key things for you. First, you need a vehicle. You need a vehicle, an impetus to act and latch onto that. It could be an incident, it could be a crisis, or it could be a disaster. It could be a movement or an existing bill that is going to move. And you have to latch onto it and attach yourselves to that, because an emergency management law on its own will have difficulty having the time in the debate and exposure to pass on its own. So you have to find those vehicles and leverage those current events. Second, it's good to understand and respect the jurisdictional lines and how they align from agency to congressional committee. I'll give you an example. The Department of Health and Human Services and the Health Services Committee, you know, the FEMA and the Science Committee, you know, Department of Transportation and Transportation Committee, they each have their own jurisdictional lines and backgrounds and authorities. And you have to respect and understand what those the basis are and what their strategic goals are in those respective committees. In emergency management, unfortunately, it cross-cuts all those committee jurisdictions. So you probably need 20 to 25 committees to align on any comprehensive emergency management legislation. So you get this, your strategy should be to pick a narrow effort aligned with that committee and topic, or you have to take the bull by the horns and coordinate across those agencies. And if so, I guess to my third point, target non-political and mutually shared experiences across regions. The nice thing politically about emergency management is that everyone has disasters. From the far right to the far left, from the rural to the urban, they all have a common threat and a common risk. And that's their citizens are in harm's way and they need help. And so if you could focus those efforts on those mutually supporting efforts, I think that's the way you get things done from a policy standpoint.
Okay. And I think also for me, and I only worked at the state level, I testified one time back at Congress on some Homeland Security topic. But I always say you need a pocket full of ideas. This is what's needed. So when a crisis happens and everybody's motivated to act, like 9/11, then you can really get some stuff done when everybody's interested in the topic. But that interest level wanes pretty quickly, and you got to strike while the iron is hot. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that completely. Yeah. That's why I mentioned these vehicles. You have to, whether it's the vehicle could be a current event that mobilizes the public's interest, or it could be a legislation that is going to move. It has to move. Yeah. And you have the agreements to attach this development onto that effort.
Okay, so now this was not on the list of questions. You can decline to answer. Do you think earmarks now being back are a good thing or a bad thing from your personal perspective? I think it's good, and I'm saying it causes legislators to have to cooperate across party lines. And, when earmarks went away, that kind of destroyed that whole tit for tat, I think. I don't know. What's your opinion? You'd be closer to it than me.
Well, a simple fact is most of the legislation that I had the honor to work on and successfully pass at the time was an earmark of one form or another. Was an agreement. It was an agreement to get something done, and that was the ability to make some progress is through an earmark process and negotiation.
Okay.
That said, when you have to acknowledge that if you do have the earmarks, you're giving a whole lot of power to a select few number of people. Comes with that is a consolidation of influence in a small spot, and that can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. That's really, I don't think I need to go any further than that.
Well, I think about the way back, well, not way, way back, but Senator Robert Byrd, Virginia, I think it was, always wore a red vest, if I remember right. He wanted legislation that ended up being the Regional Catastrophic Planning Grant. I don't know if you're around for that, but that was one of the best grants out there because you couldn't buy equipment with it. You had to spend the money on planning, and he couldn't just get it for his state, so it became a national program. And I think it's still cooking along. It died out for a little bit, but it's a great way to get just pure planning funded. And it's an example of how one single legislator made a significant impact. And by making it a national program, he got support, I guess. I don't know. Any thoughts on that? I don't know if you're around for that one or not.
I'm very familiar with Senator Byrd. I'm familiar with the grants, and I believe it helps with some mitigation measures, too.
Oh, yeah. So, okay. Well, one thing's there, Josh. We keep seeing disasters happen in high-risk areas of the country. With climate change, these risks are going up and up. You espouse a need to have a comprehensive plan for the safety of people living in those areas. What's that look like? When you say have a plan, what's that mean?
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to think of a plan as a response plan only. Response plans are good, and they should be universal for all hazards. Okay, so when it comes to this type of topic and increasing risk, and the potential growing risk of changes like climate change, I think a more difficult planning is necessary, which is land use planning. How are we going to effectively use the land, the precious little land that we have, to mitigate risks? And it's really difficult to do, but I think it's the most necessary type of planning there is. We have an option. We have a choice to mitigate, if not eliminate, risk of disasters by using our land wisely. Do we build out open space to allow the river to flood? Do we elevate lands? Do we adjust the zoning restrictions on what is permissible, what is not? What are the building codes that are in those locations at all? We have the opportunity through land use planning to mitigate or eliminate those risks. It's not easy. The response plan is a band-aid. The response plan is after the fact. And I think there's been so many investments in response planning that I think they're all generally good. And communities know how to coordinate to respond. It's the proactive strategic look into the future as far as where do we want to be? What do we want to look like? Yeah. And how do we want to mitigate? How much risk are we going to assume as a community? That's the tough planning that I think is not done enough.
And I think the big challenge there, I wrote an op-ed on this, I think for Seattle Times last year, is all those decisions. There's about 3,000 counties, I want to say 6,000 cities in the United States. And the zoning and permitting, that's all done there. That's not done at the federal level. It's not usually done at the state level. So it's really boots on the ground in those very boring zoning meetings where decisions like this are being made. So
yeah, absolutely. And there's one other element. It's I think it's infrastructure sector coordination. I think what is your strategic approach in infrastructure investment and how those utilities or companies are going to coordinate together. I remember it wasn't too long ago that we did not have, I'll give you an example, in the power industry, in the electrical utility industry, we did not have visibility in power outages. We don't have visibility to share and use mutual aid resources across private utilities. We have that now. It's tremendous. The coordination is absolutely great in the electrical power industry. That's a great model to follow. Look at all the other infrastructure sectors who have not come that far. We don't have the same visibility in the public health medical infrastructure. We don't have the same visibility in the water infrastructure and several others. That level of coordination across sectors and that planning for how they coordinate themselves and support each other, that's next step. And that's also not a federal or state role. It's a private role. And they have commercial reasons for why they do one thing or another. But that level of coordination, I think, is an investment that is required in the future.
Okay. Well, looking back, 30 years ago when I started on the civilian side of emergency management, the American Red Cross was the go-to agency for shelter operations. That is not as true today. What should we be thinking about as emergency managers when it comes to becoming prepared to offer disaster sheltering?
Well, the nice thing about the Red Cross was that they had a command and control node and means to make decisions on where to place shelters and when, how to allocate resources and share resources across local areas. So if we need to make sure that those principles are still held with other shelter options. Are they in a flood zone? Will they have continuity of access during floods, or will they be isolated? Will they have structural integrity? These are some of the things that have to be strongly considered with shelters, regardless of source. Also, will they have continuity of access across the seasons and across the year? It does no one any good if a shelter is available sometimes, not other times. It interferes with effective communications with the public and continuity. And how are they going to be sustained with regards to food, water, material, and personnel support? So having a centralized means of negotiating those types of resource allocation across shelters, regardless of the source of the shelter, I think is a key focus area.
Okay. All right. Well, before I wrap up with what's always my last question, I've just seen this significant, I'll call it mission creep, put on emergency management as a profession. The pandemic was a huge one. At the beginning, I said, well, this is really Health and Human Services. They've got it. They got the national stockpile, all that. And certainly we saw FEMA thrust in early on because they're well known for ability to coordinate, do logistics. So they picked up a huge piece. And when they got involved, that meant state and local emergency management folks got involved. But we've all seen homelessness, border issues become emergency management focused at times. What is going on now? And do you think from a policy perspective that it will continue and grow as people understand the capabilities of the profession?
Absolutely. This is a reality. It's not a, I don't think it's a debate anymore. Even through my 20 years in government emergency management, I've seen tremendous mission creep, and where the emergency management community is brought in to manage a variety of incidents, particularly those outside of its jurisdiction and squarely within another organization's jurisdiction. But I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. Why are they using the emergency management community? It's because of the complexity of the unique situations, because of the different jurisdictional boundaries, the gaps and seams in the plans and the roles, responsibilities. What emergency does, managers do, is they bring together disparate organizations with different perspectives, different jurisdictions to coordinate, and they structure that response and that decision-making process to make a decision. That's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful capability. I think it's something that should be embraced. The trick is to resource it appropriately and to allow them not task emergency managers to fix a problem and then hold it, then tie their hands behind their back on how they do it. We need to empower the emergency management community to take the lead on these missions and to enable them to access personnel and resources and experts from across the jurisdictions of which they're supporting. I'll give you an example. In most, if not any, all emergency management organizations, every employee is an emergency manager. Every employee is tasked for deployment or activation. That's not the case in the other jurisdictions or organizations of which they're tasked to support. I can give you the examples where I, as a task force leader on FEMA, was tasked to organize a public health incident. And we had access to all 5,000 members of FEMA. And I had access to 10 people in the Department of Health and Human Services. And it's over 50,000 people. So, I mean, we need to enable, if we're going to task emergency management to take the ball and run with it, we need to empower them to do so, and with the authority to, with the resources to be able to solve that problem.
Yeah. Okay. I
there's lots of examples. I give you all kinds of examples. I mean, from H1N1, H7N9, COVID, the border crisis of 2014, the border crisis of 2018, Haiti, 2012, a State Department mission, cyber incidents, FEMA was brought in for cyber.
Yeah.
According to that, Deepwater Horizon, Flint, Michigan, leaching. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Each one was a tremendous experience, unique, and actually each one resulted in refinement of our plans and policy. But it also highlights and demonstrates the role of emergency managers and the capability, the unique capability that they bring to the table that should be, I think, embraced.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this question. FEMA is a pretty small organization. I don't know. But if you can remember back to when you're talking about 9/11, I want to say there may be 6,000 employees. I'm just guesstimating there's like 25,000 now, but that as a federal agency, that is really teeny. But I've heard some people say, well, more people is not the solution. But I think as the missions grow in scope and depth and complexity and number, they don't all, I call it confluence. They don't happen necessarily sequentially. Sometimes you got multiple things going on. You think FEMA's big enough number-wise?
Again, the beauty of emergency management is they're able to leverage and scale. I mean, that's the whole principle of incident command system. So in generally, I think FEMA is big enough. I think where FEMA requires more resources is in their steady state continuous coordination capability. If they're going to be continuously on the hook for large scale or long duration crisis, they can't just rely on activating people for a week or two. They need dedicated crisis management teams to be on the hook 24/7 across the year. And I think that's an area where you need to build up their roles, not just at the headquarters level, but in the field level and regional level as well, to be able to help manage crisis over multiple jurisdictions over longer durations. And second, you need FEMA to have access to the personnel resources across the government. It can't just be pulling from FEMA personnel to deploy. They need to leverage the full capability of the federal government. And FEMA can remain nimble.
Yeah, and what Josh is referring to, and this is something Craig Fugate did when he was the administrator there. He made sure every job description that was written, and when people were hired, they were told you are eligible for deployment at the needs of the agency. And so you may be a grants administrator, but if they need you to go help coordinate logistics, whatever, you get a field assignment, you could be gone for a couple of weeks, a month, 2 months. 2017, the series of hurricanes that happened, really, I think, taxed FEMA. They were just leapfrogging people from one hurricane to the next, with Puerto Rico being that last one. So, okay, well, any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listening audience here, Josh, on anything we've talked about? Or maybe there's something we've missed.
It just the one thing is, I'm back to my role as international SOS. What I thought was most surprising was how vulnerable we are as travelers and employees every day, and the number of crisis situations at a local level, at a personal level, that we may be confronted with. And to think about what is your backbone, what is your backup support, what is your capability behind you as a company, as an organization, to support those variety of incidents. And that's where International West comes in, and the profession of emergency managers within corporate America, and within universities, schools, NGOs, is really a growing profession and a growing capability, and it's something to be proud of.
Okay. Well, I just want to say thank you to Josh Dozer for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And, today we heard from someone who has served at the highest levels of government. I hope you have enjoyed the conversation as much as I have. I certainly learned a lot about international SOS, but then how the different facets of our government interact and what we see coming down the pike in the future. And now a reminder to everyone to be safe. Think about what you can do today to become personally better prepared for the next disaster. If you like this Disaster Zone podcast, please share a link to it with your social media contacts. Thanks for listening and be safe.
Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.